Major Highfield, Reel 11. We were just got to the point where as the Falaise Gap was operation was going on, but I'd like to ask you if you could just sort of give us some pen portraits of some of the key officers within the whole of 74th Regiment, but in particular in your battery and your part of things, just pen portraits so that people can feel like they sort of know them.
Well, my battery commander was Ken Park, who was a long-serving T.A. Roger. TA officer who had been a second lieutenant at the outbreak of war. He eventually became, I believe, the company secretary for ICI.
And what was he like?
He was very calm about things, and he knew his job well. And the other troop commander was Peter Edge, who had been in the ranks in the Middle East, gone to the Middle East Okju and joined the regiment as a gun position officer at Merath. He commanded E Troop. He was rather aggressive. He carried a rifle with him on his Bren gun carrier and went into certain positions sometimes which were a little exposed, to say the least. I had been told that my main job as an OP officer was to stay alive. Otherwise, the infantry lost the possibility of artillery support. And I was a more cautious individual on the whole.
Did he fit in well into the mess as a ranker? Well, he was a ranker officer, as they used to call him in the infantry, but did he fit in well in the mess?
I mean, we were all the same. There was no... We were a very tight regiment. And when you grew up with your friends and left the regiment for some reason, you wanted to get back to the people that you knew.
Any other officers? What about Colonel Harris, was it?
Colonel Harris.
The new colonel. What was he like? What was his first name as well, if you remember it?
I don't remember his first name. But he... signalling was very important, and he decided that we would disobey the army rules and that everybody would call themselves just by what was the letter number on their truck. So A troop commander was RA, B troop commander was RB, and we went on breaking the code for some time until eventually we were told we could be recognised and it would better stop it.
Why did he want to do it that way, just for ease?
Speed of control and no mistakes.
That was important to him.
That was important. And he was very able. Later on, when we got up into Belgium, I think his actions there showed that the regiment at Geel put up one of the finest performances of controlled artillery fire that I know.
And that was, you think he had a big influence on developing the... Because the regiment was already experienced, but yeah, he had a tactical acumen and a gunnery ability.
That's right. So he had taken over because the previous colonel had been hospitalised. But he used to read the 9 o'clock news out, too, on the air, on the regimental net. We were all on the regimental net, so you could have three battery command posts and 6 OPs.
Any other senior officers? Who was the other troop commander or battery commanders?
Major Clark was the battery commander of 440 Battery, who were a regiment from Brighton. We had lost 293 in the desert, and he came at 440 Battery joined us after Alamein battle to make the regiment up to a three-battery regiment. Guy Fawkes had commanded 296 at Marath, where he was awarded a DSO for temporarily taking over command of 8 DLI when Colonel Jackson was killed. But he had left to go to Staff College. The 296 Battery was now commanded by Peter Wakelin, who was a regular officer who had joined us after the BEF in Dorset as a troop commander and was now commanding a battery. So that's Clark, Park and Wakelin.
And what about the junior officers in your troop? Anybody come to mind in particular? Or was it...
Well, my great friend Vanstone, who had been the survey officer and had been sent out to the guns when before the Battle of Gazala, had become E-troop commander during the retreat and at Alamein. And he then became adjutant, and he was the fire plan control officer in Sicily as adjutant. And he again left the regiment after the Sicily campaign to go to Staff College.
So let's get back into... just one other general point. How did you get on with the new battery when they joined you, 440 battery? Because sometimes it's quite difficult to bring in and take out a battery, you know, from a regiment. How did 440 battery fit in, would you say, just from your own perspective?
It took a little bit of time, I suppose, but when you get into these... And in point of fact, in action, you do not see anybody from another battery. You often never see the other troop. It is a little world between you and the senior officer over you, the battery commander, who will visit you from time to time. And that's isolated, really.
In England, you were away from them mostly in England. I just wonder whether there was any sort of difference in methods or friction in the mess or any problems or any things that worked well with 440 battery. You know, generally, was it handled well, the bringing of them into the regiment? I take your point that, you know, you didn't see them that much.
Well, but by the time we got back to England, we were really... There was no problem at all. They were a bit unfortunate in that their regiment was broken up after Alamein, and their division was broken up, but they at least maintained the battery structure.
Now, what was the next thing to happen then after there's the Falaise Gap incident?
Well, we were out of action for the at the end. We'd reached Condé, and there were no enemy in front of us. They'd gone. I can remember the night that we all pulled together. I must just tell you that my OP vehicle was a Bren gun carrier, which is a most uncomfortable thing to try and live with.
Why? What was wrong with it? What did you think of the Bren gun carrier?
We fitted a bar of wood right down one side with a piece of rolled up canvas. At night, we just pegged this canvas down and lay four of us underneath it on the ground. But a wind whistled through the suspension and everything. And I can remember on this occasion, it rained all night. We were on a slight slope and the water just rolled down through the carrier tracks, and we were soaking wet and in the morning. And I realised that I was beginning a malaria attack. As we were out of action, I had to report sick, and I was then sent back to the coast to a hospital in Normandy to do a short course for anti-malaria.
So what happened next? That was in August, so?
Yes.
It was in August they set off on the pursuit. Well, you know, the operations, the advance.
That's right. The pursuit, I know. I suppose it was about 10 or 12 days field hospital. Then permission was given on discharge to hitchhike back to rejoin your unit. I was now in the beachhead, and I started off after lunch and managed to hitchhike as far as Falaise, about 40-50 miles, and I managed the next day to get on a convoy which was going up to Amiens, because the pursuit across France and into Belgium was already underway. I got a good lift and reached Amiens about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, got off and took up another position watching the traffic going by. Eventually, 11th Armoured Column came through. I asked where they were going, and they said they were going to Ghent. So I hopped on one of their vehicles, and we proceeded in a northerly direction. Some time later, in northern France, the column was moving slowly, and I suddenly saw a little marker sign beside the road of 74 Regiment. I fell off the transporter quickly and managed to rejoin them that evening. And they were under orders to proceed to Brussels the next morning. So I took over my old troop, and the next day we moved across the border into Belgium and up to Brussels.
What kind of reception did you get when you entered? I presume you went into Brussels with the...
We went right into the heart of Brussels, and the reception was fantastic.
In what way? Tell us about it.
All the population were out cheering us, offering us glasses of wine, kissing a soldier if they could, etc. And we finally went into action in the centre of Brussels on a place called the Place des Manœuvres. It was a large expanse of open grassland sloping down towards one of the main railway stations at the bottom of the hill. The guns were put into action.
Fired at what?
On a zero line due south, because there were still pockets of enemy to the south in the Waterloo direction. I looked round after an hour or two. There were 20 or 30 people round each gun position, talking to the soldiers, giving them glasses of wine and kissing them, everything else. The sergeant major came up to me, and my sergeant major, and he said, "Excuse me, sir, just a question. What are we going to do about latrines?" I looked round, and there's no cover at all. So I said, "You'd better take the top cover off one of the 1,500 weight trucks and use it to set up a latrine." The next day, I went down to Beert in the southern suburb of Brussels, in the direction of Waterloo, simply on wireless control, if any reports came in of these German pockets. And this situation lasted for about 3 days.
That would be, which days would that? Would that be 4th, 5th, 6th of September, round about then? The Geel action started on the 8th, so...
Yes. About the 7th of the 7th, we were told that we would have to move forward out of Brussels to support an operation establishing a bridgehead across the Albert Canal. 69 Brigade had gone first and established a bridgehead further to the west, and we moved up, and the operation started on the 8th.
Now, what was the situation at Geel as you saw it?
I wasn't moved forward for a day or so. Peter Edge went first, and I think he can tell a very exciting story of what happened to him. But I remember the night before I was due to move forward, and I had a strange sort of sinking feeling after the contrast of Brussels and the long years of the war. Here we were going back into it again.
You were more nervous than usual, do you think?
I felt a bit depressed at that time.
However, how bad was it, or was it just a...
Well, it's difficult to say. The war lasted 5.5 years altogether, and it seemed you could hear mortar fire and small arms fire now and again. We were about 3 miles south of the Albert Canal, the gun position.
So you moved forward with your OP team?
I was called forward the next morning, and I moved forward in my Bren gun carrier and up to the crossing point, which was under some machine gun fire from time to time, firing down the canal. Got across there and moved about a mile or so further north, and suddenly there was Ken Park in the road waving at me, saying, "You've got to go with that company of the 8th. They've just started their attack on the right. Leave your carrier and take a small set." I then got the 38 set and my OPAC and went forward round a hedge along 100 yards, 200 yards, and eventually caught up with the company commander of the 8th DLI. His men were some 30 or 40 yards in front of him. As we moved along, the main road was under fire from self-propelled guns, which is why the Sherman tank stopped and were not prepared to go forward. There appeared to be nothing on the right at all. We moved slowly forward and then came under some rather distant rifle and machine gun fire, which was to half right and some distance away. I could see infantry, maybe 500 yards away, firing at us. I immediately called for a troop target and engaged them, and this seemed to be successful because those that weren't hit got up and withdrew and the fire stopped. We moved forward to a hedgerow position in front of us where we could see through a group of buildings about 150 yards away. In the front of these buildings, maybe 30 yards in front, in slit trenches, were quite a number of German infantry. You could see the tops of their helmets. And then between the buildings, I saw a self-propelled gun actually fire. I could see the discharge from its muzzle, the very end, firing down the road. At this stage, and to make sure that Colonel Harris really believed what I was doing this time, I called for a target, a regimental target, on enemy infantry and self-propelled gun, now firing. I got my regimental target. Scale 1, 24 rounds. I ordered an immediate repeat, drop 100 repeat. This, in fact, was a little bold, as a piece of one of the shells hit my OPAC harness, fortunately. It was only just in front of us. Immediately after this was the noise of the SB gun withdrawing at high speed. The infantry moved forward with encouragement from the company commander, and the enemy infantry were surrendered, and the position was taken, and that became our position for the next 2 days.
Did it have a name, this position?
Just a farm, group of farm buildings.
And which company or which officer?
I never knew the name of the company commander. We never had time to talk.
And what was it like when the regimental fire came down? I mean, what did it look like? Was it impressive, an impressive sight?
This was where Colonel Harris was at his best, because 151 Brigade had pushed forward a narrow bridgehead with the very forward 6DLI in Giel, and we had 6 OPs out, and a further one was deployed after the group of buildings that my 8th DLI company had captured. They went through, Archie Pitt went through, and we had 7 OPs out on the regimental net. The colonel was in complete charge of the net. He rationed us with the ammunition, which was in relatively short supply, with the long LFC. And we eventually, it was decided that the 6DLI were too exposed in the forward position and would have to withdraw. The orders for this were given through Ken Park's set to the forward OP of the regiment with the 6, as the infantry communications had, as so often, broken down completely. And the forward 6DLI company withdrew.
No, I know this is something you have that you want to comment on, the inadequacy of the infantry wirelesses in comparison to yours. They used the 38 set, I believe, which was that. Now, that would that be in the Bren? Was that portable, or would that be in the Bren carrier?
I carried 2 small 38 sets, or I think they were now called 88 sets, for when I deployed on foot, so that my main signaller had the small set to receive on and the big set in the carrier to relay the orders that I passed. And I had my OPAC, or myself, had the other set forward. I can remember at Merath, when going back a bit, Ian English had no wireless sets when the attack was going forward. They'd broken down.
Now, they used a different set.
And Guy Fawkes, the battery commander, gave him 2 38 sets so that they could operate.
Now, what was wrong with the infantry sets? Were they were a different set, weren't they? 18
the 18 set was, I think, the main set used. It was quite a big and cumbersome thing, which was carried on the back of an infantry soldier. And lots of small connections inside. If you got shelled and went rapidly to the ground, half the time, I think, the connections broke, and it was very inadequate. The 38 sets and the 88 sets were direct line of sight operating, and would work up to a short distance reliably. The gunner sets we had on at this time were 22 sets. Not quite as good as we thought as the 21 sets we'd had in Africa.
Why not? What was not as
they
good?
Were shorter range. I suppose it was mass production or something too. Anyway, on this occasion, the 6DLI was satisfactorily withdrawn from Giel, And I can remember seeing a tank in the next field, I think it was a firefly, fire two or three shots straight into the church tower of Geel, which made me resolve never to use a church tower as an OP, or only at the last resort. The next morning was a tricky morning because some tanks, Panther tanks I think they were, had infiltrated into positions under to the side of the bridgehead under mist. They started to pick off vehicles into my rear, which included where Ken Park and the battalion headquarters were. There was quite a schmozzle about this, and a number of tanks were hit and soft vehicles. However, eventually the Germans themselves had to move to regain their lines, and at this stage our tanks began to take a toll of them. But it was a spirited opposition in this bridgehead, formed by tanks, good tanks, two GAF regiments, and eventually some elements of 2nd Parachute. After this, the next episode was I'd gone to the bottom of a garden of a farmhouse where there was a hedge and a little outbuilding with I suppose it was an apple store, and I'd gone up into the apple store and just knocked a hole out in a little grill so that I could see forward over the field where there was a standing crop, and we watched from here, limited view. But suddenly we spotted German helmets, and an infantry section was coming down the corner of the field division in front of us at some 300 or 400 yards. We alerted the infantry, who had a Bren gun position at either corner of the farm hedge in which the building, my small OP building, was. And the second in command of the company came up to be with me. When the infantry file, which moved in bounds, was about 100 to 150 yards away, just turning a corner of a hedge, he ordered his Bren guns to open fire, which they did. However, as there was a standing crop, everybody disappeared from view, and it was difficult to tell what had happened. But very shortly afterwards, the Spandau machine gun was in action, firing back at us. The second in command of the DLI said, second in command of the company, have you got a Bren? We carried a Bren on the carrier, so we rushed down, got it up, and he pointed it through the little grill and opened fire on this brave German. After two or three bursts, there was no fire coming back. And later that night, when it was dark, the infantry went out and brought in his identification. They found the body, and he was a young parachutist, 19 years old, a very brave man, but a casualty of war.